Exhibition number 120491, Reel 1.
Mr. Meninsky, Reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in London.
And what did your father do for a
My life? Father was a painter. You have a number of his paintings in the Imperial War Museum, Bernard Meninsky.
And your mother?
My mother was... I don't know what she did for a living, to be perfectly honest. I don't know how my father met her, but they were only married for a few years. It was rather a tragic situation, actually. After I was born in 1919, my mother left my father, and she went abroad with a gentleman, and I've never been able to find out who he was. And about 18 months later, she came back to my father, and she was pregnant. And my father refused to take her back, which I think he regretted for the rest of his life. And she went away somewhere, and she had a child, as far as we know, and she died in childbirth. And we've never been able to find out, my brother and I, where she died and what happened to the child, what sex it was. It's just a total mystery. It's a complete mystery. So I was brought up temporarily by a retired nanny who had been nanny to Lord Samuel's children, Mrs. Sewell. And I went to her for 6 months. My brother went to my father's sister, to my aunt's. And I stayed with her till I was 16. And she was an amazing woman. She really was. I couldn't have had a better mother if I had chosen one, you know. I can't really define exactly how my own interest in the visual arts started, because during my childhood, I didn't spend much time with my father. I was very fortunate if I saw him two or three times a year, and then only for a day. But I started to draw when I was about 7 or 8, and I've never stopped. I mean, I must have had some influence from my father, because when I went to his house, I used to go to the studio, obviously, and look at what he was doing. And the amusing thing is that I made a drawing when I was 8, which I now have. It was given back to me after my father died. I made a drawing of myself in a mirror, and according to my stepmother, it influenced my father tremendously, and he kept it always in his studio. And when he died, she gave it back to me. I got it somewhere in the store upstairs. However, I just went on drawing, and I wanted to become a painter, and my father was reluctant to allow me to. He said, "You have talent, but I don't know how much, and it would be far better, perhaps, if you had a profession and painted for a hobby." So he had me articled to a firm of accountants, Jeffreys, Alfred, Henry and Marks, of which only Marks remained. He was an extraordinary man. He was an accountant to practically every well-known painter of the time. And, of course, it was very cunning of him, because he was a collector of paintings. So he took his fees in pictures. And that's a whole other story, actually. But I stayed there until the war started.
Where had you been educated?
At Hertfordshire, Hertford Grammar School, I went. I started off in the senior secondary school in Hoddesdon, and then I got a scholarship to the grammar school. I did, I suppose, 2 years of accountancy. I didn't like it very much, in fact, but I never stopped drawing. And by this time, I'd become very keen on youth hosteling on a pushbike. I spent all my weekends and all my holidays touring all over the country. In fact, I started doing it when I was at school. And I combined that with a sketchbook and a box of watercolours, you know, so I could do both. And I think I visited just about every part of England on a pushbike. I also think that the stamina that I built up during that period probably did a great deal to help me through my prison life. Anyway, the war started, and I tried to get into the RAF unsuccessfully, because I had varicose veins, so they put me into the infantry. which I thought was very amusing. I subsequently discovered I could have got into the RAF because my brother was a regular and had been in the RAF since he was a boy, since he was 18. He could have claimed me, but I didn't know that. And so I wound up in the Beds and Hearts, and I spent about a year with the Beds and Hearts and then volunteered for the commando, trained as a PT instructor. A little amusing story about that. We arrived at the PT school, and I couldn't understand why the commandos had chosen me to become a PT instructor. And the first day we were there, the sergeant major, who was a very tough gentleman, gave us a talk, and then he said, "Are there any questions?" And of course, in my stupidity, I said, "Yes, I would like to ask a question." He said, "What is it?" And I said, "Well, it's quite simple. I can't understand why I'm on this course. I thought I had a better brain than a body." And there was a terrifying silence. And he looked at me and said, "What makes you think a PT instructor doesn't require a brain?" And for about two or three days, I wasn't the most popular bloke on the course. But however, I enjoyed it, as a matter of fact. And I was with the commandos for about 9 months. And then I was a very naughty boy, actually. I did something which I really shouldn't have done, but at the time I didn't see any harm in it. We were stationed on the Isle of Arran. We were training on landing craft at the time. And we had, before that, been on the coast of Scotland. And I had met a girl, and so had some of the other fellows in the small town where we were stationed. And they wouldn't allow us to leave the island. And it was Christmas time. And I decided that this wasn't good enough, that we should be allowed to visit, even if only for a couple of days. So I devised a plan. I was a corporal, and I got three or four other chaps who were interested to go along with me. And we went on to the ferry, which went across to the mainland, to Greenland. And I marched them on the boat with one of them as a prisoner. So it looked like an official party, with escort and prisoner. And I got us onto the mainland, and we all went our different ways to meet our girlfriends. And all would have been well, because we would have got back on the Sunday night without any problem. But there was a very, very thick fog, and they cancelled all the ferries. And we had no option but to get in touch and explain what had happened. And when we got back to the Isle of Arran, I thought, well, I'm going to get away with this, because I'm going to plead using initiative, which is what we were supposed to do anyway. However, I went up in front of Colonel Lister, and he said that he couldn't let this go, and as I was the only NCO on the party, that he was afraid I would have to return to my unit, which was quite a punishment in actual fact. So I was pushed back into the unit, and I arrived back with the battalion, and within a matter of weeks they were put on orders to go overseas. Now, I don't think it was to go to the Far East. I think it was to go to the Middle East, because all our equipment was the type of equipment one would expect to use in the Middle East. I mean, we had pale khaki shirts and pale khaki shorts and things like that. However, shortly after that, Pearl Harbor took place, and our convoy, I would imagine, was diverted, because we went to Canada on our own troop ships. And then the American troop ships came and took us to South Africa and then eventually on to Singapore. Now, whether or not that was intended before we left, I have no idea, but however, that's what actually happened. And of course, we arrived in Singapore with all our equipment, ideal for the desert, but not exactly right for jungle warfare. However, we didn't go into the jungle. We landed on Singapore, and we'd only been there two or three days. We started to do exercises in the rubber plantations to get us used to working in trees and so on. And meanwhile, obviously, the Japs were chasing what troops there were on Malaya down towards Singapore. And we eventually did a rearguard action on the causeway to allow the troops to evacuate from Malaya.
Could I just go back a little bit? When you first landed at Singapore, what kind of impression conditions in the city made on you?
Yes, we didn't see very much of the actual city. I think the impression that we got, and the one which surprised everybody, was the extraordinary lack of preparation on Singapore. We went up to Salita Aerodrome to find, of course, that there was no aircraft there. The Japanese had virtually done a Pearl Harbor on Salita Aerodrome. They'd destroyed most of the aircraft on the ground. And we were amazed to discover that there were little or no defences against the mainland. We had to start digging weapon pits. We'd expected to find concrete bunkers and all sorts of things, but there was nothing like that. We had to start digging in. I mean, history's already told the story of the two large guns which were facing in the wrong direction, but it seemed to me that any money that had been spent on Singapore had been spent on building superb barracks, because they were superb, but little or no defences. I mean, when we were doing the rearguard action on the causeway, we just had to dig weapon pits, just as you would in any other part of a theatre of war.
What was morale in your unit like when you got to Singapore?
It was good. I mean, we had no idea what to expect. We had been told that the Japanese were all that weren't exactly very good soldiers, and they were all carrying two rifles. And I remember seeing wounded coming across from Malaya on stretchers and looking at them and thinking, if that was caused by a 2-2 rifle, it obviously wasn't. I mean, it was a piece of nonsense. But morale was very good to begin with. Everybody was fairly convinced we could hold on, but of course, as you know, we didn't. In no time at all, the Japanese... We were told, of course, the Japanese couldn't land on the island. I mean, there was no way they could land on the island. There were too many of us, and we'd just keep them off. But, of course, they landed in one part of the island, which no one had really expected, on the swamp side of the island. We had no aircraft. We ran out of artillery shells in no time at all, so we had no artillery defence. The Japanese came over and just spotted us and mortared us. And we were rapidly running out of ammunition. Our water supply was questionable. There was a story, I don't know if it was true or not, that they had poisoned the reservoirs. I don't think it was true, but we believed it to be true. And I'm sorry to say that I think the vast mass of the troops had decided that really it was going to be another Dunkirk. Because the area I was in, we had three companies of the battalion. They had taken our officers away overnight, with the exception of one or two who were left behind. I think they were evacuated to Java. And the men deserted. I mean, they just pushed off to Singapore in the hope, I suppose, of getting on boats. So where we had had three companies, overnight we were reduced to something like 40 men.
Which company were you in?
I was in B Company.
Of the 5th Battalion?
5th Battalion, yeah.
Who was in charge of your company?
The officer in charge of our company, his name now, that's a very good question, Stallard, Captain Stallard. He had been evacuated. And that was official. I mean, he had, with a lot of the other officers, had been taken off.
Who did that leave in charge of the company?
It left a sergeant major in charge of the company, Sergeant Major Bennett, a regular soldier. And over the last 3 or 4 days, in the three company area front, we had, I think, 40 men. I went down with a Bren gun carrier, and we brought back about 20 mixed people, few pioneers, few REs, and we tried to establish a position, and in fact the Japs never ever got through our position. They tried to, but it was a wonderful position because we had a slope onto a wide road, and it meant to get to us they had to cross a wide road. They captured a section of our chaps who were out on a patrol. We found them and we attacked them, the Japanese. All we could do it with was rifle and bayonet. We'd got no artillery support. And the Japanese were expecting us, and they destroyed practically the whole patrol. I led the patrol, actually.
Can you describe in detail what happened on the patrol?
Yes. We had ascertained that the section were tied round trees. In other words, they had their backs to the trees and their hands were tied behind them. And with another corporal and myself, we recced it. We could creep very close to it and could see what was happening. And we worked out the best position to approach it from, which we did. And I think there were probably 12 of us. And as we were approaching it, we were perfectly convinced we hadn't been seen. And we were just going to... In front of us, there was some triple dannet wiring, which is damned awful stuff to get through. But anyway, we managed to get through it. And we were just about to, I suppose, charge is the only word. It's a funny word to use, but that's what we were going to do. And a machine gun opened up, and it was a 4-5 machine gun, and it was devastating. Now, I can only assume that myself and two people on my left were hidden by a tuft of grass, because the machine gun swept along, and it killed everybody on my right-hand side. I wasn't touched, and the two people on my left weren't touched. And I know from experience that one big tuft of grass can hide quite a lot. So we had no option but to withdraw. And it was one of those extraordinary occasions. It had taken me about 10 minutes to get through this triple dannet wiring, but I don't remember going back through it. I must have shot through it, I think. And we got back to our position, our own positions, and we gave a message to the artillery that were behind us, who they had told us that they hadn't got any shells left. They were out of ammunition. But, however, they must have found a few, because they agreed to shell this area where the fellows were being held prisoner. And they shelled it for about 5 minutes, and we went back again, and the Japs had left. And they'd bayoneted everybody where they were sitting. And one fellow, who was very small and was wearing a pair of shorts which were about 4 sizes too big for him, because they'd bayoneted most of them through the testicles and the stomach, they'd put the bayonet through his trousers but missed him. He was alive, totally unharmed, just one. He was in a shocking state, you can imagine, but we got him out. We held on that night. The Japs attacked us during the night. We managed to beat them off. They attacked us again in the morning. And that afternoon we heard that we had surrendered.
When you say he was in a state, you mean he was revving?
Oh, yes. He was. He completely and utterly, his nerve had gone totally. He recovered. Eventually, because I remember meeting him again during the prison life in a place called Tamuan, and he was fine, so he'd got over it. But when we found him, he was completely raving. I mean, he didn't know where he was or what was happening. He was in a dreadful state.
Did he later give an account of what had happened?
I didn't hear him do so I couldn't say.
What did you think of the Japanese as an enemy at that time?
Well, by this time we were perfectly convinced they were excellent fighting troops, as indeed they were. I mean, they were extremely brave. They were obviously very experienced in the type of warfare. I mean, we were fighting in rubber plantations. They knew exactly how to use the camouflage. I mean, they'd be within yards of you before you knew they were there. They were dressed, of course, in the right sort of colours to move around in rubber and grass and things of that kind, which we weren't. We were all in pale khaki. But they were excellent troops. I mean, I was extremely impressed. And we had been told, of course, that if they captured us, they would have absolutely no mercy. They would automatically kill you. And we, of course, believed it. In actual fact, subsequently, that turned out to be total rubbish. But that's what we'd been told. And that's what we expected if we were captured. I don't think for one minute they would have... I don't know, of course, whether they would have bayoneted all those lads if we hadn't shelled them and they had to get away. And they couldn't be bothered to take them with them, so they shot them.
Did you have any intelligence about which particular Japanese unit was facing you?
None at all. I mean, we had some quite extraordinary things happen, actually. When we got into this particular position, it was a place called Thompson Village. And when we first... I think it was at Thompson Village. No, I beg your pardon. It was when we were at Salito Aerodrome. It was decided immediately to issue maps of the island to the various platoon commanders. And when they unpacked the maps, they discovered that what we had was maps of the Isle of Wight. Yes, I know. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Now, if you look at a map of the Isle of Wight, it is quite similar in shape to Singapore, in actual fact. But we never knew whether that was a simple mistake or it was an act of sabotage on somebody's part. But that's what we had. It was known that I spent a lot of my time drawing, because I had been doing so all the way through my army career. So I was put into a sort of command weapon post together with a couple of other fellows who were draftsmen, and we spent the whole night with storm lanterns tracing a map which someone had got off a school wall. And we traced them and put the names in, and they were issued as maps to the various commanders in the battalion. Now, whether that happened to other battalions as well as ours, I have no idea, but it certainly happened to us.
So you'd gone to the aerodrome and then to Thompson Village, had you?
That's right. We'd gone first of all, to do it in sequence, we went first to the aerodrome and took up a defensive position on the aerodrome. I remember taking a patrol through the aerodrome and being absolutely amazed at what I found, because as you went through the aerodrome and through the quarters, it was absolutely obvious that the place had been evacuated at a few minutes' notice, because everything was... It was like a ghost town. As you walked through the dining rooms, the plates were there with food still on them and knives and forks. And when you went through the dormitories, the fellow's stuff was just lying. They had taken very little. And there was watches lying about, wallets. They must have just been told, go, and they'd gone. And you expected suddenly to see everybody back again. I mean, there was even rifles lying about, the one thing you're told you never part with. I mean, you could have had as many rifles as you wanted. And one of the things I remember we did, we went into the officers' mess bar, and somebody discovered a cash box behind the bar with thousands of Singapore dollars in, and we decided they wouldn't be any value anyway. I don't know why we decided this. It was a funny thing to decide, really, whether we'd decided already that we were going to surrender, but we didn't even bother to take any of them. We just left them there. In actual fact, with hindsight, they would have been jolly useful, because it remained currency. and we could have certainly used it when we were in River Valley Road, you know, we could have bought stuff there. But anyway, we didn't. I mean, everything had been just left suddenly. The next job we did there was we drained off the fuel into the sea, and that took us all night to do. We just opened up the valves on the fuel tanks and just let it go into the sea, obviously to stop the Japanese getting it. I remember that very vividly because no one was allowed to smoke all night just in case of accidents. We then moved across from there to near the causeway so that the evacuation could take place of the mainland. We were only there for about 48 hours and we moved back from there to Thompson Village.
Did you see evacuation?
Oh yes, I saw, we saw quite a lot of it, yeah.
What did you see of that?
Well, that was where we were first really completely and utterly shattered by what we did see. I mean, we saw a lot of wounded being brought over. It was then that the myth of the .22 rifles was totally exploded, to coin a phrase, because the sailors were very badly wounded, a lot of them. We saw quite a few hundred Australians. The Australians, I'm afraid, were not very good for morale. I mean, they were telling us to get off the island. They were saying things like, you've got no hope, Cobber, you know, you're better to get off the island, and things like this. Not that I took any notice of them, but it must have had an effect on some people. The last thing I saw was the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders coming across, the last of them, and they were the last to come over, with the bagpipes playing, which was quite a moving moment.
Then, what condition and morale did they seem to be in?
They seemed to be quite good. I mean, they had the pride of the Scottish regiment, but the morale of the Australians was pathetic in most cases. I mean, they had one message for you, and that was get off the island.
Did you make any response to them?
Not really, no. I certainly didn't. I was very surprised to hear comments of that kind, to be perfectly frank with you. I suppose I was a bit... with my commando training, I had this sort of silly idea of youth that you don't do a thing like that, you know, and I think quite rightly so. I don't think that. I mean, it so happened that we were able to hold on to Thompson Village with 40 people, but it wasn't easy after you'd had three companies, and I expect you know this, that certainly in my own battalion, quite a number of senior NCOs were court-martialed after we were a prisoner of war for leaving their posts, and they lost their ranks. I mean, they were stripped down to private. Our Colonel Thomas, was a very strict man, and he was quite horrified. I mean, in retrospect, I was horrified too. I mean, I can remember being quite shocked to see, sort of virtually wake up in the morning and find myself with such a small number of people around me.
Had you had any sign before that this might have happened?
No. It seemed to me that once they took the officers away, and they left a few, very few, once they took the officers away, everybody decided that the end was in sight, and I'm fairly convinced that most people thought that it was a repetition of Dunkirk, and if they got to Singapore, they'd get on boats. Which, of course, didn't happen because there weren't any boats for them to get onto. Because after the surrender, we were taken from Thompson Village into Singapore, and...